This is a No Surf Music, Burning River Fireside Chat.
With guest, Demos Papademos.
I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com.
All right, so this is another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. I guess the closest river is the Mahoning, is that right?
It is.
All right, so this is Mahoning River edition then.
Yes.
And I am in Warren, Ohio at the moment with Demos Papademos, everybody's favorite Irish folk singer. How you doing, Demos?
I'm pretty good, Jason. How are you?
I'm not bad myself. We were just hanging out in Niles, which is, I guess, the next town over, more or less.
Right, essentially.
The Record Connection, good local vinyl and
local record store owned by Jeff Burke.
Indeed,
a big supporter of music.
Yeah, Jeff is really great. If you're anywhere in the area, go support his store. He always makes sure to help out the local musicians, which, you know, is a wonderful thing.
Exactly.
And we were there specifically to visit with our friends Angela Curley and the Howlin' Moons.
Right, it was a vinyl release.
Indeed.
Their album, Homemade Vision, right?
And it's a beautiful, beautiful cover and a great album, at least in my opinion. What do you think of it?
I think it's a great album as well.
There you go. So that
I like all of their stuff, so, you know.
It's hard to find any Angela Curley mistakes,
right?
Let's put it that way.
I mean, I've probably listened to Hey Kid more than any of them. And, you know, not to say that I think that's a better album, but it's just, I've listened to that one more.
Right. Right. Well, it's been out longer, too. So you've had more
opportunity. Yeah, right.
So, as long as we're talking about it, for those who do know Angie and the Boys, what do you think about the difference in sound between their last album, Hey Kid, and the new one, Homemade Vision? Do you have any opinion on that?
Definitely a difference, somewhat. Certain songs from Hey Kid, I think, could have worked on the new one. But maybe something like Ghost, maybe. But, I mean, a little bit less kind of Americana and rootsy kind of territory. Especially, you know, songs like that had that Stonesy kind of, by rootsy, I mean kind of like in a classic rock kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And there was just a little bit, there's a difference in the textures. I mean, some of the, like, you know, like White Dove. That song right there, you know. So, I mean, I think there is a difference in the sound. What are your thoughts? I think the songwriting is strong on both of them,
mm-hmm.
and I think that the everything is strong, but it's just different directions, kind of.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, if you read my review, I definitely.
I have not.
Well,
I've read a little bit of it, but
You're just a horrible loser, Demos.
I'm giving
That's
you honesty. I'm giving honesty.
Fair enough. It's very verbose. You know, it's hard to get through. But I think I completely agree with you. It's I think much less country centered,
right?
Album. You know, they always had sort of that alt country, more on the alt side. A lot of rock influences and just sort of
right. Some
country coming in. But right. This time I thought it was much more of an indie rock kind of effort with a lot
right.
of like
I mean, I was
studio.
Kind of, I was trying to find a different way to say, because I mean, I hate, you know, pigeonholing anything by saying, well, this sounds more indie rock,
right.
It sounds more contemporary, because then, you know, anyone could fire back and say, well, what is indie rock and
right.
what is contemporary,
right.
you know?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you have these terms, they're just so broad that in some ways they
right.
can almost encompass anything, but,
yeah.
you know, I feel like, It was definitely an interesting direction that they took, and did a lot more in studio, I think, than they ever have before, as far as
right.
production and all that. So, great album. I think we
yeah.
both enjoyed it. So,
definitely.
You know, for those of you listening, if you haven't checked it out yet, Angela Curley and the Howlin' Moons, Homemade Vision, well
great,
worth your time.
Great musicians and great people.
Indeed. But that actually. It's a good segue into talking about your own music, because
right.
you have a fairly new album out
right.
yourself.
It was actually
right
released
here.
On Record Store Day, and the first show that I did for the album release was at the Record Connection, which you mentioned. That was, I think, April 20th, somewhere around there. 23rd, maybe it was.
Okay.
But yeah, Record Store Day, 2016, released Waiting on CD, and now in the fall it's going to be released on vinyl.
Yeehaw.
Probably early November. So, you know, leading into that holiday season where you can sell a little bit more, and, you know, the gig schedule will pick up a little bit.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. So, but
so if anybody is looking for Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa gifts,
yes,
whatever works,
they could buy the CD as the stocking stuffer, and the full present is, you know, the vinyl.
For the real devotees, exactly. Of Demos Papadimos.
They might need both copies.
Indeed. Yeah. So, you know, if you're in the area, stop by the Record Connection in Niles. I'm sure that Jeff will have plenty of copies.
Exactly.
And if not, DemosPapadimos.com is where they can find
yes.
you. If you can spell Papadimos, you're a better man than I am. But I'm sure if you Google, you'll find him.
Right.
So, obviously, I made the joke about being an Irish folk singer before, but
right.
you of course, are of Greek heritage, and your music is sort of a blend of Greek and American roots. So
right.
I call it Greco-Americana.
Greco-Americana.
I think it works
from
well.
From the first review.
Indeed, indeed. So I officially coined the term, I believe. But I think this album, kind of leading from what we were talking about with Angie, you know, it does go in some slightly different directions than the last one. I think on the one hand, you know, it's more country.
Right.
You added a wonderful Pell Steel player, Al Moss,
right.
and
Al Moss,
a number of tracks.
One of the greats, really, in the state of Ohio and it just in general. I mean, kind of a legendary guy almost, you know. I mean,
absolutely, absolutely. I mean,
he plays in a great band, Hillbilly Idol,
indeed,
based around Cleveland, and you know. But you know, his addition was great. I mean, to the project, and that did take things into more of a country kind of. I mean, anytime you add the pedal steel, you know,
yeah,
it's going to do that. But go on, you were saying.
No, well, I was saying, I also feel like, you know, obviously you're. Previous album, Wandering in the Wilderness.
Wandering Through the Wilderness.
Through the Wilderness, excuse me. So Through, Not In, Not
right,
Lost,
right, right.
You know. But, had obviously a lot of Greek influences to begin with. But
right.
I also felt on this album maybe there were some ways you incorporated it even more.
Right.
Into the background in some cases or into the foreground.
Right,
with,
right.
Some more bouzouki.
There's two songs that were written... You know, as bouzouki showcases,
right?
Of, you know,
right. So, how did you land on that particular set of styles for this album?
Right.
Was it just a natural thing, or was there an intentional?
The album began really in the beginning of 2014. The last one was released in 2013. You know, Wandering Through the Wilderness, and you know, so we began initial work. You know, on this one, in early 2014, and my intention was to get a very live-sounding album.
Mm.
And we should also mention Pete Revere, an Amprion recorder. Amprion recorder is his studio here in Youngstown, Ohio. And Pete, you know, I got to know Pete, and he was interested. You know, I was going to record the album with him, and Pete initially didn't really want to do that much of a live record, and he wanted to push me more towards a studio sound. And you know, we did record some things early on that were kind of live in the studio, and it went well. And I mean, there's a couple of those songs that are, you know, on there. So there it began really, you know, as trying to do, you know, a live sounding album. And then within 6 months, the bass player who was playing with me wanted to get out of the project, so that kind of delayed things a little bit, and Pete was pushing me more towards having a little more production and bringing in someone like Al Moss and Chris Leonardi, who plays a Hammond B3, and he's on about 50% of the album as well. So we began to move towards more of a studio sound, and I mean, I think there's a pretty good synthesis of more of a live and a studio feel. And, you know, in terms of the Greek influences, I mean, that was, you know, always an intention to have a few songs on there that, you know, just, you know, serve as kind of a curveball, but within, you know, under the umbrella of roots music. And, you know, it's just something that I do, you know, as a musician. I mean, I enjoy playing, you know, folk music, and some of it's, you know, American stuff and some of it's Greek stuff.
Right, right.
So it was always, you know, the thought of, well, why wouldn't that be incorporated into the record, you know? And, you know, some of the songs, in terms of the more country sound, I mean, that some of that was just Al Moss's influence. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, a song like Second Street, I mean, we did the basic tracking of that, and that was done live in the studios, the basic guitar, vocal, drums, and bass. And then, you know, gave the song to Al, and he came up with the main riff, and it just made it much more of a country song, you know. But again, you know, country's kind of a big influence, you know. I mean, on me, I mean, you know, I think Hank Williams is about as great as it gets, you know. I mean, Johnny Cash was always a big influence, and I've always loved that kind of stuff, so.
Indeed. And you draw a lot from old bluesmen as well.
Right, right, right. Right.
Who in particular, on the American side of blues, would you say has influenced you the most?
Well, I mean, I always liked a lot of Chess Blues, you know, Muddy Waters and Sonny Boy Williamson, Howlin' Wolf, all that kind of stuff. I mean, but then there are the earlier acoustic, you know, bluesmen like Robert Johnson. I mean, Blind Boy Fuller has always been great. And I like the Mississippi Sheiks. The Sheiks, is that what you...
However you want to pronounce it.
I think Mississippi Sheiks is technically what it would be.
I mean, when you're down in Mississippi, you can pronounce stuff however you want, I guess.
That's true. Sounding like a northerner here.
Yeah, well...
But,
Greece, or...
right. But, no, I mean, they were a great, you know, African-American string duo.
Mm-hmm.
They did a lot of great... And, I mean, I do some of their stuff live mm-hmm. as well. So... But, you know, and the record, you know, at its core, you know, it's a singer-songwriter's album, just as my last one and pretty much everything I've done. But there are, you know, there are different kind of back roads that I go down.
Right.
With kind of the Greek detour and then the, like, folk blues detour. I mean, there are two traditionals on this. I mean, there's Ragged mm-hmm. and Dirty, which is an old blues song. And there's Little Sadie, which is an old murder ballad.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, I mean, those made it onto the album because they were a great part of the live set. And it captured something that happens at the live show that would be missing on the record, you know. And that was really what the intention was of keeping those two songs on there, you know. And putting them kind of side by side.
Right.
You know.
So what for you then, do you feel, or why for you then, I guess, was it important for you to capture sort of the live feel of your concerts on the album? I mean, is there, you know, a particular tradition that comes out of for you, or is it?
Well, I mean, I've always liked the feel of a live band, and it's one of the most difficult things to really capture on mm-hmm. a record. And I mean, I've probably spent more time than I should have trying to do that and, you know, failing, you know, many bands have done that. I mean, you record gigs and it's a great performance, but the sound really isn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
Or you go into a room to record something live in the studio and it doesn't work out. And, you know, I've always been influenced by folk music and, you know, the kind of thought that, you know, Woody Guthrie went in and, you know, just recorded things kind of live to tape, and there weren't, you know, 50 takes of a song. And, you know, Bob Dylan, I mean, a lot of what he did, you know, and still does to this day is, you know, not obsessing over it and just going in and doing a few, just getting the live sound, you know what I mean? And, I mean, I've always tried to do that, and as I said, I probably spent more time than I should have with that, you know. In fact, some of the proudest moments I have on this record are the ones that weren't done that way. I mean, 50% of the record was tracked live, and 50% of it was done, you know, everything at, you know, one at a time, kind of. You know, for those that know anything about recording, I mean, you typically start with the drums and get a scratch vocal and a scratch guitar, and then you start adding other layers like a bass part or an organ or a pedal steel or violin. So, and that's how we did about 50% of it. And, you know, Pete Drevere really guided me through that and through the process of the album made me a better recording artist and a better studio musician. And, you know, I really thank him for that. And at the same time, I pushed him to go a little more towards doing live in the studio things, and he's doing a little bit more of that as well. So I think we reached a great compromise, you know. And the album, as I said, it began in early 2014, and we finished up all the tracking the summer of 2015.
Right.
So it was about a year and a half, and then spent a good amount of time making sure we had the right mixes last fall, you know, probably October, November, even December, just going over things and just making sure that we had everything level, you know, and then, you know, through the winter, just focus on putting it out and lining up a lot of shows. I mean, just regionally, really, but pretty healthy, steady schedule of shows through from April through September, you know, promoting the album.
Right. And now you're about to take a break to head back to your ancestral homeland, correct?
Right, my dad and I, we're going to Greece.
You do that pretty much every summer?
Every year. Well, I mean, it's not always summer.
Well, okay.
It's when it was when I was, you know, a kid in school.
Fair enough. So how have your trips over there and spending time in Greece itself influenced your music?
Well, I mean, I think it's influenced my music just being able to go out and hear, you know, a lot of great Greek folk music, like the rumbetiko music, which is kind of the Greek blues, which, and I discussed this in my last interview, that's the stuff that I'm very interested in. And, I mean, I bought a bouzouki on one of my trips to Greece, you know. And actually, when I studied over there, I took some lessons, bouzouki lessons, although I didn't learn much at the time. I mean, I ended up learning more later when I lived in New York and took lessons from a bouzouki player over there. But, you know, the firsthand, you know, experience of Greek music, you know, Greek folk music, you know, outside of a setting like, you know, a Greek-American dance or wedding or baptism, where you're really more in touch with kind of the roots of it. Although, I should say my family's from Athens. My dad, I mean, and I should say my dad's Greek and my mom's American. And it was through my mom that, you know, I first got into Bob Dylan and, you know, all the great singer-songwriters of the 60s, 70s, you know, which led me back to the roots, you know. But my dad is from Athens, and you know, there's a lot of, so, I mean, I'm not like out, you know, on an island or in a village like that. And a lot of the music that I like is more of an urban folk music, like the blues, you know. So it's not as much like country music, which is a little different, you know. So.
Well, you know, it's sort of the same dynamic as it is here, I guess. You got different versions of folk, depending on whether
it's
Appalachian folk or New York City folk or something like that. So,
we'll take a look at it, you know, Appalachian folk and then something like, you know, Nashville country, in a way, which, you know, to the uninitiated, kind of, you know, somebody might hear some old, you know, country song and think it's like, you know, traditional music. It's like, no, it's popular music, but it's just kind of an urban version of that.
Right. I gotcha. Interesting. So what about on the lyrical side? Because you know, I think you've got a very philosophical kind of writing style.
Right.
Which, of course, plays into the entire history of Greece in some ways as being
right.
You know, center of culture and thought.
It's more questions than answers.
Yeah, well, you know, most of life is, right?
Yeah.
But do you feel like, you know, the sort of that Greek thinking tradition influences you more, or is it more like guys like Bob Dylan?
I think probably guys like Bob Dylan
more.
Yeah, definitely, probably more, you know. I don't know.
Last night, we were actually out at Cedars in Youngstown.
Seeing some other great bands.
Indeed, indeed. White Buffalo Woman and a couple of other
great locally based band, Radio Lark.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. They're a lot of fun. And then some guys out of Pittsburgh, the...
The Red Lines.
Red Lines, indeed. So that was a fun night. But at the end of the night, about 3 a.m., I believe... you were talking with, now I can't remember her name, but, the blonde woman,
Chris Ratushin of Radio Lark.
Right.
And, Brady, a friend, Brady Secret, who's a great supporter of music, and, I mean, she goes out to a lot of shows,
mm-hmm.
and she's been hanging out at Cedars since, I mean, you know, for years and years, you know, since it was, like, the original Cedars, and, but she lives in Cleveland, and she supports a lot of bands, and just is one of those people that, you know, is not a musician, but just genuinely supports music.
Very cool.
So anyway, but we were having, I think...
Yeah, she mentioned something about, you know, you writing a song about her. You remember that?
Oh, yeah,
And you
and
said...
I said, well, it'd probably be... It's something like, it'd probably be bitter and sad or something like that, right?
Pretty much. I don't remember the exact words you used, but yeah, it was something along that line. And
I thought you were going to get around to when I was reciting Closing Time, Leonard Cohen.
Well, we could do that too if we want to talk about Cohen. But no, although Cohen is another example.
But Cohen's a great influence, of, you know, and I mean, his live bands have always had a nice little, like, you know, Mediterranean element to them.
Fair enough.
You know, whether it's Javier Mas, the Spanish guy, and he had another, I mean, in the 80s, he had an Armenian guy playing the oud with him. But anyway, I'm digressing.
No, fair enough. But I was just going to, you know, say, like, you definitely, you're one of those people who sort of packages sort of darker lyrical content within oftentimes, you know, somewhat bright and active music.
Right. No, and I think I did say something like that, something about, like, you know, bitter songs set to upbeat music or something like that.
Yeah, right. So I guess, is there a particular reason?
Is there a precedent? I think that, you know, I can write fairly upbeat music naturally, but lyrically, I don't know if I, you know, and it's a very writing. It's almost like the difference between comedy and drama, and how, you know, humor is more difficult to pull off, you know, and I really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But if, you know, getting back to folk music, I mean, if you look at a lot of old folk songs, they're tough songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's upbeat stuff people can dance to, but it's even like Little Sadie, the murder ballad.
Right.
I mean, you know, people want to get up and dance to that. And I mean, at many shows when we do that, people start dancing and then they make some comment like, oh, nothing to get you dancing like murder ballads,
yeah,
you know?
You know,
and even in the Greek tradition and Greek rhombetical music, I mean, all of the songs, I mean, people will hear it, and if they don't speak Greek, it's like, oh, this looks like some... It's like some stereotypical Greek dancing, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, but the songs are about heartbreak and just rejection and desperation and, you know, alcoholism and all these, you know, like tough themes, you know. So I think there is a precedent for
mm-hmm.
that, you know.
So is that something that you sort of came to through your own love of blues? I think it just came naturally.
It just came naturally, but probably through all those influences sinking in, you know.
I gotcha.
I don't know. I think in general, though, I mean, there's a lot about sort of searching and finding some kind of meaning, you know, that goes through all music,
mm-hmm.
you know, and... I mean, it's really, if you just boil it all down, it's searching for meaning and kind of searching for love. And I think all these songs, None of them are love songs, but love is present in all of them, you know?
Well, it's either present or absent and noted by its absence.
And noted. And noted. Bitterly.
Yeah. Noted. Well, I think, you know, a perfect example of that is the title song, Waiting.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And
well, that's written, I mean, that, you know, that was one of the earliest songs done, and it's one of the songs with the bouzouki. And, it, you know, it was one of the first songs, and, you know, the idea was, well, there should be some strong bouzouki showcase somewhere in here. And so the lyrical theme is about rambling around Greece, kind of. I mean, it's all about that. And it's, you know, essentially the concept of, you know, what is tangible, you know what I mean? What is real? I mean, the main line of the song is, you can't lose something that wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you really tell that something was there? And I think that, you know, talking about, you know, Greece, you know, an ancient place, kind of, I mean, you know, you're looking around and see a lot of ruins. And, I mean, that is sort of present, you know what I mean? I don't know. Is there any specific kind of reference point, or, I mean, do you have a question about it?
No, not in particular. I guess, you know, my thoughts of that are sort of similar when you you sort of set, I guess you set the setting,
right,
in that song, and you can,
right,
feel almost me never having been to Greece or whatever,
right,
but you know, you can sort of feel like the there's the, you know, the oppression of the heat, or, you know, going through,
right,
and
kind of the search,
right,
for something in the, you know, in this old world city, and, you know, it, and it really kind of reflects the search of, you know, in love. I mean, that, I mean, you think that you've felt certain things, but, I mean, can you really tell? I mean, you know, I mean, with time, memory blurs.
Right,
you can't,
right.
You know, I mean, you can't lose something that wasn't there. So maybe it really wasn't, you know?
I guess that's one of those great mystery of life things that you kind of have to leave as an open question,
right?
Right,
right,
that's
right.
Sort,
right,
of what you said, like there's more questions than answers, I think, in a lot of your music, which,
yeah,
is kind of what makes it so much fun.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Another, I guess, sort of introspective, sort of looking back kind of a song is one you just completed a video for, which is Red Letter Days.
Oh, Red Letter Days, yeah. That's,
yeah,
one of my favorites on the album.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that and sort,
okay,
of what you were thinking,
and, you know,
when you wrote it?
In terms of, and we were just talking about the whole bitterness, you know, the bitter is probably harsh. It, like, the songs are more wistful, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are a couple bitter lines, but it's really more wistful and reflective, you know. But Red Letter Days, I mean, that's, I really, really was happy with the recording of that one. And we tracked some of that live, but not all of it. We went back and, you know, re-recorded things. And, you know, of course, Al Moss plays the steel on that, Chris Leonardi, Hammond B3. I laid down some electric guitar for that, which I don't do a whole lot of. So that was fun, using one of Pete Revere's old hollow body. I think it was a Gibson. But it was nice doing that. And but are you lyrically for the song?
Yeah,
kind of,
I mean, you know, obviously, if you have any particular notes on the music besides that.
Right. But, well, I mean, it's, I don't know. It speaks for itself somewhat. I don't know. It's hard to pinpoint, you know, specifics for what, you know.
Fair enough. Well, I guess,
I mean, the Red Letter Day is kind of it's kind of, you know, again, bringing some kind of religious kind of imagery with the concept of the red letter days of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I mean, they are whatever you want, you know, whatever they were to,
right,
you.
Right.
You know.
Well, I think, not just because of the title, but thematically too, it somewhat reminded me of Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days.
Oh, really?
In some ways, it's kind of the same thing. You know, you're looking back on sort of the past and,
right,
you know,
there's a whole lot of that on my writing.
Yeah. Which, I mean, you're a relatively young guy, too. It's not like you're, you know, one of those old bluesmen who, who's...
Well, hey, I studied history.
Oh, there you go.
That's what I majored in.
So is that where you feel like a lot of it comes by, your, like, sort of larger perspective? Because, like I said, I mean, I think you're a very philosophical writer,
right,
which means you have to, you know, have a broad perspective,
right,
on a lot of different things. It's, you feel like your love of history and sort of the way that you look at the world in your own life?
I think there's a pretty strong connection there, whether it's, you know, my musical taste or my kind of reading interests. I mean, as much as I love literature, I'm really quite drawn to reading history, and even the dry history books of graduate course kind of style, you know. But I think I would agree with that, probably, you know. Sometimes it's, you know, you can go forward by moving, like by looking back at least. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
At least, you know, as long as you're not, you know, kind of like holding yourself back. You know?
Well, I think my favorite line on the whole album lyrically,
mm-hmm,
is probably going to get flubbed when I say it, but... I believe it's the world can be round or it can be flat. It all depends on angles
and
the stage of life you're at.
That's it.
Okay.
That's from the song Restless Time.
Right.
And that was the last song we did on the record.
Yeah.
And it was one of our favorites. You know, it ended up being one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And that line, I mean, that was kind of, you know, writing that, I was really trying to summarize the essence of my perspective, and that line. Yeah, I'm glad you pinpointed that one, because that's the right one.
Yeah, you know, I do what I can.
Right. No, but that's it. You know, it's just everything in life. It just depends on how you look at it.
Mm.
I mean, you know, objective, subjective. I mean, all of it. It's just you see what you want to see. And you believe what you want to believe. I mean, just look at what's going on politically. We don't even need to touch on that. But, you know, it's September of 2016, and just look at the alternate visions of this country that people have. And it's like that with everything.
Right.
You know, it's like that, you know, and everything in life comes down to that. You know?
Right.
It just depends on your perspective, and, you know, and where you are in life, and just all of it, you know.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, individually, one of the things I think you were trying to get at there, too, is, you know, the stage in life part. You know, obviously, when you're younger, you have a certain view of how the world works. And as you move along, you start to learn, maybe not so much. And,
right.
I think one of the things that plays into that, too, is travel.
Right.
Which I've been doing a lot of. And,
you have.
Yeah.
You know, more than I have these days.
Well, you know, you're going to get out there more soon,
yeah,
I hope.
Yeah.
So that'll be good for you. You know, I think you getting to travel back to Athens, probably
you see,
you know, different ways that, you know, entirely different culture lives.
Right.
I think, you know, that kind of plays into it, too. And you see, you know, people do things differently. But
absolutely,
that doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that they're different.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's something that our country, in some ways, is kind of lost perspective on right now.
A lot of people haven't left the continental United States.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of people haven't even left the state they live in.
It's very, very true. And I think, you know, for me personally, I think probably the greatest thing you can do to open your mind, just get out there and go places,
mm-hmm,
that you've,
mm-hmm,
never been, and see things that you may never see again, and
right,
talk to random people in tiny little towns and coffee shops.
And if it makes you uncomfortable, maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, right?
You know, right?
I mean, I think that's, you know, again, I don't want to get into a major political discussion either, but, you know, I think a lot of it right now, our issues are just based around fear of the unknown.
Right.
You know, I think one of the great things about, you know, music, that lets you sort of see different perspectives and open up your mind, kind of like yours does. It's asking questions. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I may not know, you know, what the answers to some of this right. are, but I want to bring up this right. topic so we can all kind of, like, share in it for 3 minutes while I'm thinking about it.
Right. Well, that's, yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I mean, most of my songs are questions to some extent, and it's, you know, as you say, it's philosophical, you know, without getting, I don't want to start sounding pretentious here, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know.
It starts, and it's, we started that 20 minutes.
Yeah, right. It's a little late, buddy.
Yeah. But, no, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it is, and that's a whole other topic. I mean, how to, you know, intelligently articulate, you know, what the essence of your work is without sounding pretentious. I mm-hmm. mean, that's a tough thing to do. Anyway. But it's always easier to talk about other people's work. But
well, that's why we started off with Angelo Crow
right,
and Howlin' Moon,
right?
Right,
right, right. And then
worked our way into the guy who's actually sitting in front of me.
Right. I mean, it's more questions, and I mean, there really aren't. You know, the songs I write aren't necessarily songs with a lot of characters in them coming in and out of them. Which I mean, there's all kinds of different approaches to writing, but it's more just like a pointed. You know, pointing a mirror within, you know what I mean? And just, you know, just reflecting, you know, on the, you know, as we said, like the kind of philosophical reflections that you have. And you know, I mean, what's more important than the direction and the perspective on the world we live in and, you know, life, you know?
Right.
Well,
I think one thing that you have in common with Bob Dylan, who, as we mentioned in our last interview, you
probably the greatest influence me of any musician.
And you can definitely see it in your work as well. But I think, you know, one of the things that he does so well and that you do is, you know, you find a way to kind of distill those big questions into, you know, 3 or 4 minutes.
Right, I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, it's one of the reasons why your music is so interesting to listen to, I think. And I mean, I think you tend to do it a little more on the nose. He tends to hide it behind layers of
he's always worn many masks.
Coherence. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think it's very much the same thing. It's you know, asking questions and then leaving it up to the listener to sort of decide.
To answer those for themselves.
Indeed, you know? Indeed.
I mean, there's certain songs that aren't... I mean, like the song Another Story, you know, that kind of poses questions. And that was intentionally done as sort of a war-themed song. And, I mean, I wanted to put something... And there's a long tradition of, kind of, you know, songs about wars and battles. And, I mean, out of that, you get a lot of protest music. And I wanted to kind of throw that in there. And that, you know... And, without anything specific, the addition of some accordion to that, we started taking it more into like a Balkan territory. So it's somewhat, you know, and if you look back on, you know, the Balkan Wars and all that, which is pretty recent history, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's, I don't know how I started talking about this, but that's, I mean, but still that's asking some questions,
right.
You know, about, you know, and I think out of the whole political reference, but.
We could, you know, discuss the Balkan Wars forever, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that the bombing of Kosovo was let's not get into that. Anyway, long story.
It's in 99, I think.
Was it? Well, seems about right.
Anyway.
Long time ago, what you can do.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, don't get either Demos or me started.
Yes, let's not get off track here.
Yes. But let's return back to the album and the second track, which is Second Street.
Yeah.
That one, I think, is it sort of does the same thing. It's talking about life. It's talking about you know, how it progresses, and sometimes, you know, your own personal views. But I think it kind of sort of hides the philosophy a little bit more than some of your others. Can you tell us a little about that song and how
that was written earlier? I think I began something around that. I mean, that song was a leftover from Wandering Through the Wilderness. But I had written some of that when I lived in New York. And, I mean, I lived near 32nd Street. And I always thought, you know, somehow about bringing in 32nd Street, but then it just became 2nd Street because it worked.
Too many damn syllables,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and so that one came from there. And I mean, there's also a little bit about the power of music in that one, about every fading song in your mind is like a lifeline, and all the phrasing and rhyme, you know. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, there's already work I'm putting in on the next record, you know, and the ever revolving band lineup. At this point, Ralph Rich, the drummer, is the only one who's been, you know, with me for, he's been playing with me for almost 4 years now.
Right.
So right. He's been the most committed. Sandy Quatson, violinist, she is not involved as often, I mean, due to other commitments, but she still may appear here and there, we'll see. And, you know,
right.
There's a revolving bass chair. There's a revolving role for the bassist, and but you know, I don't know. But Ralph plays. I just want to, you know, credit Ralph here for playing the drums on the whole record. And other than me, he's the only person that is featured on every song.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And the addition of Dave Lynn on guitar to my band came at the very end of this record, and he actually played bass on Restless Time. But he's now playing lead electric guitar and doing the acoustic guitar parts when I want to play the bouzouki.
Right.
So Dave has become much more of a core member to
mm-hmm.
the band.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which
will take the next record in some other territory. So we'll see.
Right.
I'm kind of curious
right.
to see how that goes.
Well, I am too, because, like you said, I mean, the sort of the latest addition and the one that, you know, makes a lot of difference to your live set is simply having an electric guitar
right.
there.
Which I always resisted
mm-hmm.
earlier, and I mean, some of that was the stubbornness of Demos Papademos. Let's just say it. No. But, I mean, some of it was, a lot of it was trying to reach some kind of folk purity.
Right.
And, you know, like Old Crow Medicine Show, always loved, I've been a big influence. I think I've said this before. You know, they became big when I was around 18, 20 years old, really expressed what I was feeling in terms of folk music. So with that, and, you know, other bands like the Hackensaw Boys, with that kind of template of, like, no electric instruments.
Right.
I just wanted to keep it that way. And I've kind of grown out of that. I mean, I've done some good things with that, but, I mean, it's just too limiting to keep that out. And, I mean, the first, you know, the first concession, if you will, was when, you know, Pete was kind of pushing me to do a little bit of, you know, electric guitar in the studio. And, like, we did the Red Letter Days part. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, began just hanging out with Dave more. And Dave is a local musician here in Youngstown, and he's played in a lot of great bands, and he'd been involved in many great projects. And, you know, he just became into it. We brought him in the studio to do a few things. As I said, we needed a bass part for Restless Time, and that just led to him becoming a member in the band. I mean, how do you hear the addition of electric guitar? I mean, the last show you saw
mm-hmm.
was in Kent, the Art House in Kent, which is a house concert venue. And it was kind of the full band experience with Al Moss being there
mm-hmm.
because he plays live shows with us, but not all the time because he's involved in a lot of projects.
Right. Yes.
Al's
a guy.
Right. We had Sandy on violin, you know. So you saw everything kind of, you know, the songs that go into the folky territory
mm-hmm.
and then you've got kind of the Greek stuff and then, you know, the fiddle songs and the pedal steel songs.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, to me, Al seemed like the most important element
right.
that's added or changed something. I mean, there's no way to avoid the sound of the pedal steel. Like, there, like, it's going to make a big difference.
And I've learned so much about the pedal steel.
Yeah.
Just working with a pedal steel player. And it began in the studio, obviously, but, you know, obviously, I've been hearing pedal steel on records for you know, years and years, and I've always loved it, but it's a different thing when you're actually playing with someone in your band.
Right, right.
You just learn about the tones. I mean, it's just, and you really realize how amazing of an instrument it is.
Uh-huh. I mean, there's nothing else like it. There's no doubt. I mean, it is one of the craziest machines that man has ever... It's like a Rube
Goldberg.
It is,
and I think it probably is one of the greatest musical contributions that the United States has given the world. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah.
Steel.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's very uniquely American. It is, I mean, the sound of that, that's, you know... And there's actually, on the record, the song Bitter Cup that I wrote, which is... I wrote that... as an old Greek rumbetiko song.
Right.
I mean, and the lyric and the whole thing, the intention, and that's even more deeply sort of in Greek roots than the song Waiting, which we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much like a Greek rumbetiko song. And, you know, the idea was to just write, and I am fluent in Greek. I mean, we should just say that. So, I, you know, the language is not a problem with these songs.
Apparently, we're currently sitting right next to your old Greek school, so...
Right, but I mean, I learned more, you know, at home and in Greece, but the intention was to write a song lyrically that could be translated word for word to be in Greek. And, and so it's very much, and, you know, it... But at the end of that song, it goes into another song, Halfway Real, which has this pedal steel intro, which is, you know, if geographically, if you were placing these songs, I mean, there's no question that after this kind of, you know, very Greek sounding thing, like, you're going down south in the United States somewhere, you know. So, but the sequencing is intentional. I mean, that's very much who I am, kind of, to be able to put those two things side by side. Be like, well, you know, this guy loves a good bouzouki, but he also loves a good pedal steel part, you know.
Well, and you really can't argue with either of them. I mean, they're,
I've discussed, well, should there be one record that, you know, I don't know, it's a 5-song Greek EP, and then the other one, it's like, well, wait, why not just have them together and see how they sit next to, how it stacks up one next to
another,
you know?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, not even, like you say, there certainly are songs that are more one direction or the other, but almost all of your work really blends, you know, both traditions in some fashion.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, sometimes you pull back a little bit on those sort of like Greek kind of gypsy melodies or whatever,
right,
and you go
right,
for more
right,
like
right,
traditional
right.
American melodies or, you know, whatever. But there's always something present there, which I think is one of the cool things, you know. I mean, anybody who reads my work knows that I love fusion music.
Right,
whatever,
right,
sort of, like,
right.
You take
right,
two
right.
things that shouldn't be stuck together and stick them together
just
and it works. It's just awesome. Yeah. And I think that's one of the coolest things about what you do. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah. I also think at the same time, like, you were talking about, you know, there's nothing more American than pedal steel, and there's probably nothing more Greek than a bouzouki.
Right, right.
But, you know, there's also a loss of those two instruments, at least in America. I mean, I don't think the bouzouki's going anywhere.
No,
Greece
the bouzouki
anytime
isn't
soon.
Going anywhere.
But here, like, I think, like, you know, the pedal steel, you know, there are so few people who can play anymore, and it's really lost from the consciousness. I think just having that out there for people to hear it
and
in that case, preserve it. In the case of bouzouki, you know, it's let people in America who maybe have never heard an instrument like that experience it for the first time.
Right.
I think that's kind of an extra added cool touch to what
right,
you do.
Right.
And especially to have them side by side, you know, it's
right.
something you don't hear every day, let's put it that way.
Right. Well, and, you know, I mean, getting back to some of the things we discussed earlier, I mean, the pedal steel, I mean, now it's seen as a very kind of, like, rootsy, old kind of instrument. But, I mean, at the time, it was quite an innovation, you know. And even the bouzouki, you know, the bouzouki, I mean, like, the four-string bouzouki was an innovation of a Greek bouzouki player, Manolis Hiotis, in the 50s. He added fourth string and, you know, not having a droning DAD tuning. And that kind of revolutionized bouzouki playing because it was more like a guitar, you know. And so, I mean, you know, some quote that I'm going to misremember, but, you know, tradition is an innovation of an earlier time. I forget who said that. It was in Greece that I heard it. I was a musician. I forget who it was. It was on a TV program, actually. But, okay. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said there, that, you know, tradition is an innovation of an earlier time.
Right, right.
You know, and the embrace of different things. I mean, like the pedal steel, you know, just, I mean, was it sometime in the 30s or 40s that they first developed that?
Yeah, I do believe. I mean, it was, you know, at the time, literally just guys taking a lap steel and bolting it down and putting some pedals on it and see what happened,
kind of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true. Like, you know, if you listen to traditional American music in the 1800s, that would have never been there because it hadn't been invented yet.
Exactly. And I mean, Greek music from the 1800s was quite different than, you know, Greek kind of folk music of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, I think...
And some will argue that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but some will argue that, you know, the concept of traditional folk music began with the recording industry's rise. And sort of, you know, the earliest things recorded, the earliest documents shaped, you know, later on, 20, 30, 40 years later on, what people saw as traditional music.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's a very good reason that you can say that country music was born in Bristol, Tennessee.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that music didn't necessarily exist beforehand, but... You know, once you had recordings of the Carter Family or Jimmie Rodgers or whatever, like, oh, well, that's country. That's something
can
we
can only begin when it's first documented.
Right.
Documentation is, you know.
I mean, and there's a, you know, there's a, obviously, a different forms of documentation, too. There is an oral history.
The oral tradition.
You know, that was passed down from a lot of you know, immigrants who came to this country with their own, you know, country's past history and sort of blended it and.
But that changes.
South,
that
and, yeah.
changes much. I mean, just tell somebody a story, and then the next day, it's changed. Even the details, everything. You
right.
know?
Well, I mean, that's why you can find, you know, hundreds of different versions of every real folk song out there, because
mm-hmm.
you know, before the first recording was made of any given song, you know, it had already been through thousands of iterations of telephone.
Right.
You know, one guy adds a little bit here, one guy adds a little bit there. I mean, you know, even, like, I know you're a great fan of Leadbelly.
Yeah.
As am I. And, of course, you know, he's credited with writing a lot of songs that he didn't really write.
He was
a
songster.
Yeah.
He was just stringing things together a lot of the time and creating something new.
Absolutely.
Know? And that's...
I mean, he, you know, he learned a lot of his stuff through his uncle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Goodnight Irene, for instance.
Right,
you know, he got that directly from him. How much of it was,
right.
you know, from his own mind?
Yeah,
how
yeah.
much of it was from his uncle's? How much was from whoever the uncle learned it from?
Right,
how, you know,
right.
you can never really tell. And that, you know, that song
you're leading me into other things I want to mention. Now.
Well, go ahead then.
What with Leadbelly? What did I want to say? Well. You just mentioned Goodnight Irene. I was actually listening a couple weeks ago, actually driving back from that show that I did with Angela Purley
mm-hmm.
In Granville. But I've been listening to this Ry Cooder box set. And Ry Cooder is another great influence of mine, and I was listening to his mm-hmm. version of Goodnight Irene that's on Chicken Skin Music. Are you very familiar with Ry Cooder's stuff?
Yeah, I don't know that particular album.
That's a good record.
Nope.
But, you know, Ry Cooder is another guy who has synthesized all kinds of random folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you'll hear, you know, like, there's a great live album of his from that time period, like, 76, 77, Showtime. And, you know, like, he does one song, and it's like, you know, blues guitar thing with slide. And then the next one, he's got Flaco Jimenez, the accordionist,
mm-hmm.
who's played with all kinds of great people. You know, but and it's sort of, you know, a Mexican accordion song, you know, and sung in Spanish, and you know, then the next thing is a gospel song, and the gospel singer. So I mean, this you know, his vision is kind of synthesizing all of these disparate elements,
right?
And I mean, Ry Cooder's done all kinds of. I mean, look at the stuff he did at the Buena Vista Social Club, which I mean, he was more just producing that. But and then there's all the like Hawaiian slack key kind of stuff, and then his like
right,
and you know that kind of. You know, I mean, he played with the Stones and the kind of was, is supposedly, you know, the one that was teaching Keith Richards some of those some of those chord changes that, you know, formed that kind of like that like brown sugar kind of riff style. And so, but I just wanted to throw that in about Ry Cooder. And there's something else about Lead Belly that I had to say, and I don't know. Something about, no, well, you know, how, yeah, Lead Belly was, and, you know, with Woody Guthrie as well, you know, Woody Guthrie didn't really write that many melodies. He just picked it up, and, you know, there's this modern perception of sort of, and it just has to do with the way we look at things today, and how, you know, the recording industry and just everything in general has stripped us from looking at things in that way. I mean,
lawyers too. Let's not.
Well, yeah, that as well.
It's all about ownership
and
money.
But you know,
money.
Woody Guthrie. I mean, you know, some people want to like diminish that and say, "Well, you know, he didn't write that much." To me, you know what? To me, that just adds depth. It's reference. It's an added layer to a song. It's a reference to something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean,
and I was thinking of Ry Cooder as well because, and he didn't really write that many songs. Early on, I mean, and it was just all these different references, and there's just such a layered depth to doing that, you know. And I mean, you know, Dylan obviously has that as well, but he's more of a lyrics guy. He's, you know, really a poet. So I mean, he was able to do that. I mean, early on, he was doing a lot of traditional stuff, and then he kind of got back to it in the '90s. But he was able to, you know, like take a song like Blind Willie McTell, which I do believe is one of his best songs. But it's, you know, the layered dimension that you can get in including that, these, you know, it's like with Lead Belly. I mean, all these different songs, lyrics that are taking you from one world and into another, and a melody that's like this other folk song that's, yeah, it's, I don't know. I can go on for a long time about this stuff, man.
It's all fair.
I hope it's sounding coherent.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what you were touching on, it's the difference between the traditional thought process about songs and the modern post-recording thought process.
Right.
You know, I mean, for somebody like Woody, it was perfectly natural to say, oh, I like this Carter Family melody. Let me write
I'm going to write my own lyrics, too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, because that's what people have been doing for hundreds and hundreds of years. Oh, I like this song, but I don't like this verse. Let me change it. There wasn't really necessarily the same kind of sense of ownership.
Yeah, and that carried on into, you know, all kinds of other, like even like some of the early rock and roll hits. It was like the, some of the Chuck Berry stuff. It's like there'd be like one song that was a hit one year, and then he would write another one like the next year that was kind of like that.
Right.
And, you know, a modern listener would be like, oh, he's out of ideas. He's just ripping off his own thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at the time, it was just like, oh, well, that was successful. Let's try another one of those.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean...
or it's like, you know, how many versions of the twist are there? I mean, there's the twist and then twist again. And
yeah,
then, you know,
exactly.
Let's twist a third time. And, guys, I need to make a car payment, so let's twist this summer, too.
Right,
and, you know, it's like, please, somebody twist. I need, you know.
By the end, it's please, somebody twist.
For the love of God, man, somebody twist. I just need to sell an album. You know, and that sort of is the corporatized version of that.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, you know, it's amazing how I think our, like you said, you know, after Bristol was really the start of it all, you know, and it how our notion of what music is and what creating music is and all that has changed. You know, it's in many ways it's a good thing because we're able to experience music that we never could have before. I mean, you know, had we been living 200 years ago, let's say, and there was this guy named Woody Guthrie who wrote all these songs, well, you know, we might be able to read the sheet music or whatever, but we would never be able to hear Woody Guthrie.
Right.
But, you know, we invented this thing called recording,
right.
So now I can go
home
and, you know, bring him up on my computer that he could have never imagined, the power of Pandora or whatever,
right,
and it's like, you know, it's kind of a fascinating thing to look at.
Yeah, when, you know, the touching on that, I mean, you know, things like YouTube have made tracking down old folk songs a lot easier for people, you know. I mean, I remember a time before YouTube
Oh, yeah.
You know, and when, you know, like going to some like little record store and finding a compilation of like Blind Boy Fuller.
Yeah.
That's the only way you could hear that.
Yeah.
You know? And this is, I mean,
which
we're just
is
talking
so much more
and
fun.
We're, and we're just talking about like 2004. It's
right.
Not even like that far
right.
In the past, you know, but, and YouTube started 10 years ago, 2006. And even right away, not everything was up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely took a while, but yeah, I think, you know, it is a major cultural change, I think, in a lot
yeah.
of ways.
Yeah.
Which actually brings me to an interesting question, I think, hopefully, which is, you know, as a musician,
mm-hmm.
And as somebody who obviously takes his writing very seriously, you know, like I said, you're still a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a lot more that you're going to come out with and whatever in your career, but, you know, what kind of legacy do you want to leave? What is it that you want maybe your children's generation, you know, if you
right,
ever
right,
have
right.
children or whatever, to get out of your music? Is there, have you ever thought about that? Or?
I don't know. Not that much.
No?
Because I look back more than I look forward. I'm kidding.
You are a history
no.
guy, but I
but,
mean.
No, I mean, I, you know, I think that, I don't know, at least creatively, I mean, a lot of it is just focused on the moment and, you know, being the best. But I think, you know, obviously, you know, I want to leave something behind somehow. Some kind of statement about, you know, the legacy of folk music
mm-hmm.
and of all these different genres, you know, whether it's the old Greek stuff or the, you know, the kind of bluesy stuff or the country stuff or the, you know, I mean, this is all music that is typically kind of, even Dylan, this is all music that's kind of somewhat associated with people, with a generation or generations older than what mine is, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's, you know, the enduring power of just good music. And, you know, lyrically, I think the songs speak for themselves. Know, in terms of what legacy I'd like to leave,
right, and you know, like we were saying before, you know, you're the kind of guy I think who asks a lot of questions and
right.
maybe doesn't provide a lot of answers. So, in a lot of ways, you know, it's a legacy in and of itself is I think just driving people to think about their own lives, perhaps.
Right.
I think in many ways that's a beautiful thing because you don't know what the perspective of a
right.
person who's going to hear your song is, and they'll
you
have
really
their own
don't.
Take on it.
You really don't.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a Leonard Cohen quote when what should they ask him? It says something about, you know, his music being, you know, for sad bastards. You know, and he says, well, you know, the thing is, some people, you know, kind of acknowledging that many of the songs are, you know, sad. Depressing, that state of mind, you know, being in a depressed state of mind, I mean, often it's the comfort you get out of hearing music that is that expresses that makes you rise out of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's certain
people say, I don't want to listen to this, it makes me feel depressed, but you know, but at the same time, if you hear something, you know. The power of a sad song is that it makes you transcend that.
Right. And it's sort of an empathy kind of
it
thing.
Is,
like
yeah.
feeling that, oh, well, this guy gets it, so obviously I'm not the only one, you
yeah,
know, or,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, you know, whether that comes out in first we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin, I'm not so sure, you know, but hey, that's not a sad
what
song.
Is it,
but,
what is it, the line about the monkey and the vine. What is it? It's like.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I can't even remember right now either. Yeah, we're both working on a limited amount of sleep last night,
yes.
So probably not the sharpest. On, yeah, well, especially happens when you hang out at a dive bar until 3 in the morning the night before. And,
right.
But that's the life of a musician, right?
Right.
Speaking of which, just to close up here, I want to talk a little bit about something that you and I and a number of our friends have been talking a lot about
mm-hmm.
lately, which is just the process of the modern music scene and being an independent artist, being a band leader, you know, trying to get yourself out there. First of all, on the band leader aspect, because, you know, we were talking about your lineup changes. And there have been,
you know, quite a few.
Indeed. But I guess as the guy who's in charge, you know, as the guy whose name is on the CD and whose name is on the marquee, you know, and it's Demos Papademos and his band.
Well, yeah, I'm getting out of that. I mean, I honestly would like to have a band name.
Yeah.
But it's got to be a good one.
Right.
And I don't know.
I keep suggesting Demos Papademos and Botticelli's Nieces, and you keep rejecting it, but I would love to see Ralph play with a skirt. I just think it would be hilarious.
So the band is in drag.
Yeah, why not, you know? Maybe we can get...
an all-female band?
Well, I don't know, man. That's up to you. If you have the skills to get the Robert Palmer girls or something,
right.
Go for it, right? But can you just, you know, give people an idea for our listeners out there who, you know, maybe have never been in a band, you know, what is it like to be in charge of all those moving parts and to... you know, bring it all together into a cohesive whole, hopefully.
Well, it gets pretty, I mean, it gets emotional, you know, with people. And, I mean, the only comparison that I can make is, like, being in a relationship with a person. And, you know, it's like, it becomes like a relationship. And it's like you've got a series of girlfriends. I mean, the band members, you know what I mean? And the personal, and everyone, and you never really know what the other person is expecting out of it. And, I mean, sometimes when band changes, you know, arise, when they have to be made, it's emotional for people, you know, and it's tough. I mean, you've got a certain investment that I can only compare it to, like, the kind of like a relationship, you know. I mean, like, telling someone that they're out of the band is kind of, I mean, it's like breaking up with someone,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well,
and I mean, there can be good breakups, you know, but...
Well, especially if you get a good song out of them, that's, you know...
Well, yeah, that's
but, the beauty
no,
of being a songwriter.
But what's it like being in a band? So part of it is, you know, kind of an emotional connection. And it's very, you know, it's a very personal thing, you know. You can have people playing in a band with you, and, you know, what they're doing is technically great. But it might not serve the song that you're trying to do. And to express that to someone, I mean, it's almost like telling you don't like them or something. Like, I mean, and, you know, you have to...
Well, in some ways, it's almost like telling them you don't like their kid.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
like, right. Their creation.
You're right.
But it's a difficult thing. It's like with
your
artwork.
Your child's pretty to
like
you.
With artwork or photography, I mean, how can you say to someone, well... You know, I don't think it's that great of a photograph. I mean, you can't really...
Oh, people tell me that all the time, but I'm a shitty photographer, so...
Well, but, I mean, you know what I'm trying to say. No, that's part of it, and... But at the same time, you know, I'm the band leader, and, you know, everybody enters kind of knowing that, you know, they're my songs, and, you know... Asking me if it serves the song pretty well, and, I mean, you know, mature players... Understand.
Right. And I think the relationship analogy is good. I would take a sports analogy. You know, I'm a baseball fan, like
right.
long Indians fan.
I didn't
fan.
Know that.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I really miss the days of the player managers. You know,
right.
like we used to have guys like Lou Boudreau in Cleveland or somebody who, you know, he was on the field every day, but he was also making all the decisions.
Right.
And I think
right.
in a lot of ways, that's what a band leader is, you know.
Dave Lynn, the guitarist in my band now, he's talked about that. He's a pretty big sports fan.
Yeah.
And you know, he's talked about, he's always found, you know, a similarity between musicians and athletes, even though they're kind of different personality types.
Right.
But, you know, we both rehearse and, you know, you have different lineups, then you've got the performance, and you've got, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's actually similar, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I think you do have sort of the same decision-making, you know, abilities and issues. You know, a lot of it just comes down to personality management, I think. And,
well, yeah.
yeah. but to you, I mean, you haven't done a whole lot of touring a large area. You mostly play local shows.
Mostly regionally. Yeah, I mean, the other things I've done for the way, sometimes I just do them on my own.
Right. Well, I do want to talk about that in a second, too, but have you found there's really certain personalities that really work in a live band and certain ones that don't? And
like, oh, definitely.
What do you feel like are the key elements that you really need to be a road musician?
Well, people need to learn to just roll with things. You know, and just take things as they come and to understand, you know, how their etiquette has to be when entering a club, and just get in, you just set your stuff up, and you know, I mean, there are all kinds of different musicians out there, and I mean, there's the guys that come in complete disorganization. They don't even remember to bring like a DI if they need one, and they're trying to, and you know, that's horrible. And then right. There are other people that take themselves too seriously, but they're not very good. And then you've got other, and the real kind of pro with it, you know, has their gear, has their setup, they know what to do. They, and you know, Dave Lynn is like that, you know, and Ralph Rich is like that as well, the drummer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mentioned Dave first because he's older than Ralph and he's been in more bands. But you know, they know their gear, they show up, they do the setup, they do a check, and then it's like, let's wait for performance time. And there's just a professionalism, and you just have to roll with it. And you know, no matter what the sound situation is, you need to know what's going to work for you.
Right.
You know, and I mean, that's what you need. And you know, for musicians that are going gig to gig, they've got to understand, because every room is different, every sound guy is different, every crowd is different. They need to know what they need to do. And you got to play to a room.
Right.
You know, if you're a drummer, you got to play, you got to figure out, you know, play to the room. If it's a, you know, don't play too loud if you don't need to. If it's a big place, well, maybe you can do a little bit louder. You can hit a little harder, but you got to, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect, you know. Because, I mean, there have been times that I've, you know, screwed things up as well. But, you know.
Well, it's all a learning process, obviously.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the thing is, you know, what works on stage sometimes doesn't always work in the studio. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference. I mean, there's some guys that are very committed to doing a lot of gigs. Like, just because that's what they do.
Right.
But the studio is kind of an afterthought.
Right. And there are certainly people on the other end who are absolutely phenomenal studio musicians who just don't belong on the road for one reason or another.
Yeah, and in a way, that's a better way to be. Because you can control your legacy better that way and what you leave behind. Because the record's always going to be there.
Right.
Whereas a live performance, you may get documents, and you may get great documents. You know, but something about live music, you know what I mean?
There's something about it,
you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably anybody who is listening to this right now is a fan of live music, or they wouldn't be sitting on my crazy website that discusses it in many terms. But, you know, I think there's just something special about the experience. And, you know, no two performances are ever alike. You can play the same set list with the same lineup.
And you can drive yourself crazy trying to capture what the perfect one is. And I've done that.
Yeah.
Well, even like with this record, some of it was like another story. We tracked that. We'd been doing that live for about almost a year, I think, by the time we did it. And early on, we tracked it separately. And then we ended up, it just wasn't right. And then months later, we went back in and tried to capture it live. And like one day was devoted entirely to that. And I mean, finally, I thought we did get the energy that it had. But, you know, I've definitely spent too much time. And I started out the interview saying that I've lost time.
Right.
Kind of trying to capture something that can't be captured.
Right.
You know. And sometimes you just need to let things be. Just don't capture what you can. I mean,
well, and I think this goes back to that line that I quoted earlier about perspective, too. You know, I think you're in a certain phase of your musical life too, and you know, maybe what you did that works last time doesn't work now, or
right, it doesn't, it
won't work in the future, or it's you know you'll learn something new, and
well, that's how you grow. And the thing is, you grow most of the time creatively. I mean, you discuss all kinds of different artists, musicians, and you say, oh, well, you know, they had this period, and then they went into this. I wonder why. But
right.
It just happened naturally. And that's how it is when you grow. You just grow and you don't even realize that you're doing it. I mean,
very few
times in life, you know, creatively do you say, well, you know, this was the specific, decision. I woke up one morning and made it. It just happens on its own. And then
right.
you look back at the previous year's work and you find a certain theme and you look at the year before that and it's something different. And you'll find the turning point later on, but it's not
right.
at the time. It's, you know.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about being me, is my job is to sort of ferret those things out and to figure them out. In some cases, even before the musicians.
Right.
I mean, I know, you know, not to bring them up again, but we were talking earlier about Angela Pearlie and the Hollow Moons. And,
yeah.
You know, just talking to Angie and Chris, I was out on the West Coast, but we did a little FaceTime interview before I did the review of their last album. And, you know, getting Chris to even acknowledge that there's a stylistic difference between Hey Kid and Homemade Vision was tough, because I mean, he just went in and played what he felt like playing. And you know, to him there wasn't really a difference, because it was just, you know, him being Chris Connor,
right?
But the Chris Connor who was playing on this album is different than the Chris Connor who played on the other album 2 years ago.
2014 Chris Connor is different than 2016 Chris Connor.
Exactly. And you know, I think a lot of it is just sort of how it naturally flows. You know, you may go into the studio with a certain vision of a song and
it becomes something else.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it takes an outside observer sometimes to look at that and to say, well, you know, I see the strains that flow through both of these, but here's, you know, a different direction that was taken here that, you know, 2 years ago might have gone
right,
180
right,
degrees
right,
or something
right,
like that.
Right.
So I think, you know, that's like you said, it's all growth and it's all like the
right,
phase of
right.
life or the phase of musicianship or
right.
you know, just
the
way
angle.
You happen to feel
right.
that day.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, maybe even the next day you would have taken
yeah.
that solo completely differently because you got a better night's sleep or you,
right,
you know, whatever
exactly,
it is,
right.
you know? So,
and I have yet to really find what the next direction for the new songs is going to be. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think it's probably more along the lines of a song like Restless Time or Red Letter Days, but I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I probably have almost like 50% of another record,
mm-hmm.
not recorded, but, you know, kind of together. And actually, I mean, additionally, I'm working on doing more solo acoustic recordings
right.
for a project with Pete Trevere. And he's really kind of, in fact, last night he was telling me that he's really kind of perfected the live in the studio set up with some old vintage mics, you know, like the ones that they recorded Dylan with in the 60s. And Pete Trevere, again, just to give him his credit, I mean, he has a great studio, Amprion. In Youngstown, Ohio, and he was a big part of this record that I put together, and he's got an incredible knowledge, and he studies, you know, what different studios were doing and what mics they were doing, you know, back in the 40s or the 50s, 60s, although he's more like 60s, 70s kind of.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to be doing some solo recordings as well, probably put some project out, maybe not even in, maybe just kind of an online thing, maybe not a,
gotcha.
Like a full release, but with old folk songs and, you know, something like alternate versions of songs in a stripped down setting. So we're going to work on that. And I mean, we've already recorded a few things for the next record.
Okay.
And as I said, I'm collaborating a little bit with Dave Lind, the guitar player. We'll see what comes with that. I mean, I have songs written. Maybe turn them over to him a little bit,
right.
And see what he does with them, you know. And, you know, certain things. I mean, I don't know. I can see the violin becoming a little more minimal. For a time there, it was something I really wanted to have as, and you know, songs of mine like Barrier Doors, you know, If I Had Religion, they're, I mean, all kind of important
mm-hmm.
songs. All have, you know, prominent violin parts.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I always saw the violin as being an interesting instrument because it's in so many different traditions, not just like classical versus fiddle, but I mean, you know, across national boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's
you know, the violin is big in a lot of Greek island music.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In Crete, they've got the lira, which is it's a fiddle, you know. So, I mean, you hear a lot of it there, and you hear it through the Balkans, and you hear it through, you know, all over Europe. And,
right.
And, you know,
and I think it definitely is one of the things that brings out the Greek aspect in your music, you know, even though your violin player isn't necessarily steeped in that tradition,
through that kind of Balkan and gypsy influence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the violin's an interesting, you know, it's so interesting because it can, you know, one minute if you're hearing a gypsy thing, you're somewhere in Eastern Europe, and the next thing you're down south.
Right.
You know. And it can have the sophistication of classical, which, you know, I mean, it's, you know, kind of like what people think of when they think of sophisticated classical music. You know what I mean? It can. So that's why I always had the violin in mind. But I'm just not writing as much with that in mind.
Right.
You know, when you've got the pedal steel and electric guitar. And
right.
We'll see where it goes. You know.
Indeed. Well, just to wrap up, you know, we just talked about being a band
leader. We could just keep going.
Oh, we could too.
For like
three
more hours.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I don't want to kill our listeners' ears too badly. But
where are we? Anyway, how many minutes in?
Who knows at this point.
Whatever.
We'll figure it out.
Go on.
This is the problem with you and me. You get us together and we just talk.
Right.
Again, that's why we're called Burning River Fireside Chats, Burning River Fireside Canned Radio Questions.
Right.
But no, you mentioned you are recording some solo stuff, and you
mm-hmm.
have been booking more gigs recently, I believe.
Solo gigs.
Solo.
I think that's,
And, you know, I've seen you in both settings, and I think, to me, you know, the solo operation, obviously you can't do the same kind of full sounds that you can with a band simply because you've only got, you know,
one
in your case, and two instruments, in your case, a guitar and a harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're much more limited, but it also gives you the chance to break out and do songs that you could never do with the band,
simply because you would
have to teach five people how to, you know, or do the arrangement and do all that. Whereas, you know, if you want to play a Lead Belly song, you just need to know the chords
and you can go right
into it, you know. As a performer, do you feel like there is that kind of a big difference and you know, which...
what, solo acoustic versus full band?
What kind of freedom
huge.
It gives you
and
all that.
Yeah, yeah.
What can you tell people about, you know, how you feel up on stage when you're you know, on your own rather than being...
Well, when you're on your own, I mean, it depends on what kind of a room you're in. And, I mean, you know, it depends on the attentiveness of the audience and, you know, what the expectations are. I mean, of the performance and the setting and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got a good listening crowd, I mean, you're really connecting people on a more emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the lyric really takes the spotlight. And, you know, I like being able to do that, you know, being able to sing a song like, let's say, Red Letter Days without the band. I mean, it's great with the band, but, you know, there's no distraction. I mean, not to say that the everything, the rhythm and the different instruments are a distraction, but when you just strip it down to
mm-hmm.
its essence, you can really get to the core of a song.
Mm-hmm.
And you can communicate with people. You can communicate with people on a more direct level, provided they're, you know, willing to be receptive, you know.
Right.
I mean, sometimes some people just want to dance when they go to shows.
Right.
And that's how they enjoy live music. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So the full band allows you to be more kind of entertaining a lot of the time. You know what I mean?
Right. It's I think it's sort of the difference between cerebral music and foot stomping music. You know?
Exactly.
I think.
And I like both.
you know
what I mean?
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the things that I find so interesting about, you know, what you do. And your recordings and
mm-hmm.
your live sets with the full band is, it is extremely intricately written
mm-hmm.
lyrically, you know, and you obviously think very deeply about it, and at the same time, like, you've incorporated all these different elements that do make it entertaining.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
I guess, you know, like you said, if you're in a good listening environment, though, stripping it down
right.
and pulling all those elements out really does make a huge difference mm-hmm. and sort of draws you in, because there's no other sound there. There's, you know,
right,
just a guitar or whatever. It's like, well, I'm going to sit here and listen to this and try and figure out what he's talking about.
Right,
rather
exactly,
than, like,
exactly.
I'm gonna, you know.
And, I mean, there are moments on the record where we kind of do. I mean, this the last song, Who Would Have Thought? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that kind of has the feel of, I mean, it, you know, especially in the beginning of the song, but, I mean, it kind of has the feel of an intimate solo performance, you
right.
know. And I guess, in a way you're saying it's kind of like, it's like the thinking man's foot stomp in music or something, or like the introspective like
right,
foot
right.
stomp and stuff.
Well, in a
with
lot
with
of ways.
Some history lessons,
yeah,
and
you know, somewhere in there you hopefully learn something, but at the same time you enjoy the whole thing musically.
Right, right, right.
You know, I think one of the things I personally like about your solo performances is it's not that strict singer-songwriter thing where it's literally just I'm going to sit here and you're going to basically listen to me philosophize and I'm going to strum the guitar a couple times. You may, you know, you can call, like, there are some musicians who get into that,
right,
you know?
Right, right, right.
Whereas, you know, you tend to keep things more compact and you're a damn good guitar player, without a doubt, and a fabulous harmonica player, and so
you
can bring those elements out,
right,
and I
right.
think it really...
Well, it makes it more entertaining as well. And I do a lot of blues things,
mm-hmm.
Folk and blues, but it ends up being more blues, kind of. And some of that's being able to do some blues harp things, which is nice. You know, live, it's nice to be able to do that. It's, you know, it's not just fun, but it's something I enjoy doing.
Right.
You know, the like musical challenge and just like playing the blues and. So I do more of that, absolutely, and that kind of breaks it up from just kind of keeping it in that, you know, there could be a few detours
mm-hmm.
from just thinking, you have a couple introspective songs, you know, and then you can take a little detour and hear some blues. I mean,
right.
I think that's always nice, you know? And I mean, I don't really do much of the kind of Greek-influenced things on solo performances. I could, I mean, further... In the past, I did some things like that. And there were shows where I did some bouzouki.
Mm-hmm.
But the bouzouki is... You need an accompaniment. Someone else. Some other... You need... Basically, bouzouki is played over a guitar or some other instrument. So it's like, you know, two people are needed.
Mm.
You know? Although you can do some things like, you know, open tuning, kind of drone-y stuff. But... I don't know. Maybe I'm not there. I'm not. I don't know. Maybe I haven't put enough thought into it yet. So,
well, maybe eventually you'll get around to that.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see.
You did talk a little bit about, you know, your upcoming recordings and,
yes.
and what you're doing for that, but just, you know, looking ahead, I guess, to your musical career in toto.
Right.
What do you think the future holds? Like, are you?
Well, the immediate future holds. The release of Waiting on Vinyl
mm-hmm.
in early November, and you know, a fairly steady lineup of shows to finish up the end of the year. So from the beginning of October, from the end of October until the end of the year, we're going to be doing some pretty frequent gigging. I mean, you know, around Ohio, like we'll be down in Columbus, and you know, we'll be in Pittsburgh. I'm going to go out to Chicago and do a show and as well. So, you know, just doing a little more gigging and at the same time also more studio time for
mm-hmm.
both of those projects, you know, the next album and some of those solo recordings. So that's the immediate future,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, we'll see what happens. I don't know.
There you go. Well, like you said, it's all about questions and not necessarily
right,
about answers.
Right. Maybe I'll get the answers.
Yeah, eventually.
Maybe I'll get them by, like, after this next round, I'm going to figure it all out.
There you go.
So the next interview, I'll be like, Jason, I figured it out. This is what I was talking about before. I've got the answer now.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to that
okay.
for sure.
All right.
But this has been a lot of fun chatting
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, it's been great.
Once again, I want to thank Demos Papademos for joining us for a Burning River Fireside Chat once again. The current album is Waiting, It is out on CD, MP3, and all that right now. And like you said, the final edition will be out in November.
Yep.
So if you are a crazy audiophile, that is the way to go.
Yeah. And there, I should mention, there's a couple music videos.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. In the past year, I've been doing a lot of music videos with my friend Chris Ratushin, who has the band Radial Arc, and Colin Tabara, who has a band called The Zoo. I don't know if you've heard of them. But we filmed actually really in the past, and I know I'm digressing a little bit here.
Fair enough.
But in the past year, a little over a year, we've done 4 music videos. 2 of them are earlier songs from Wandering Through the Wilderness, when I released a 45 of Double Knots and Barrier Doors. We did those videos, and then 2 from the new record, Restless Time and Red Letter Days. And Red Letter Days we filmed out in New Jersey, because I have, from my mom's side of the family, we have a house out in New Jersey. So that's another kind of, you know, element to Demos' life, the whole Jersey thing. So it was nice to be able to bring that into one of the songs visually, at least.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And hang out at the Stone Pony a little bit.
Yeah, we went up to the Stone Pony and the Asbury Park.
Yeah.
And, in, you know, there's the Greek Archbishop Athenagoras, there's a statue of him outside there. So we put that in the video, which is kind of a nice little, you know, combination thematically.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, go check out some of these videos as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And your YouTube channel is under just Demos Papademos, right?
Demos Papademos.
So once
again,
it might
be something like D Papademos,
oh, there you
17
go.
Or something.
But yeah, go ahead and hop on YouTube and check that out. Or you can, of course, see both of those videos on the No Surf Music, No Surf Review of Demos' album Waiting. And we'll have a couple of sound clips up there, too, so you can check out some more of the album. But you know, like I say, it's available now in CD and MP3. And wait in a month or so, and you'll be able to grab it on vinyl. It's well worth it.
Yep.
If you're in the Northeast Ohio area, or now stretching out soon to be Columbus, and play a fair bit in Pittsburgh as well, hopefully expanding his territory, mm-hmm. You know. Get out and see the band or Demos solo. I guarantee it'll be a great experience for you. So thank you once again for sitting here and chatting with us, Demos.
Yeah, not a problem. Thank you as well.
Yeah, it was a great time. I hope you at home enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. This has been another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. So have a great day.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.